This is starting to feel like an audio diary of sorts. It's been 3 days since I've last not spoken to some incredibly talented, smart person, and they just keep coming. I don't know how much longer I can keep this up. My mind is strong, but I don't know if my voice can keep up with this for much longer. But I have to try or die trying. What a day on the couch, or rather the fluffy white chair that looks a bit like a polar bear. We had Dr. Amanda Kavanagh with some great tips on safe sedation for any situation, including reviewing some of your favorite sedation and anesthetic drugs. Dr. Shane Bateman talking about business models that provide for a spectrum of care. Prof. Michael Shear riffing with us on antivenom use in the American snakes compared to the Australian snakes. Surgeon Dr. Paul Aldridge with tips on how to not freak out when faced with a bleeding abdomen post-trauma when it's not just bleeding from the spleen. Dr. Matt Booth sharing some thoughts on how we get ER vets to not disappear from the land of ECC after just 3 or 4 years. Dr. Leo Londoño talking about whether our patients need IV fluids after a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory overdose, and the legendary Dr. Temple Graydon with a few tips for neurodivergent vets. Wow. On the couch, I was joined by Dr. Ellie Lester and Dr. Lisa Brumby, both from Animal Emergency Australia, where I get to do my clinical work. Check out the link in the show description for the shift survey that Dr. Booth mentions to be heard on how you'd like to have your shift structured as an ECC vet. And don't forget about a 40% discount on the Vet Vault clinical subscriptions for the duration of IVEX, as well as 30% off the world's most eco-friendly high-performance running shoes / work shoes from Tarkine Shoes. Okay, let's go. Dr. Amanda Kavanagh talking to us about sedatives, sedative combinations. The alpha-2s, they are actually, they're pretty good at maintaining blood pressure centrally. Am I right or not?
Yes.
If that's part of your pre-med, because even though they go peripherally bluish, is that why we've started using them again? Because we've realized that centrally they actually give it or not?
Yeah, the alpha-2 agonist, well, they'll vasoconstrict. But the combination of vasoconstriction and bradycardia, despite maintaining a normal blood pressure, if you were to measure it, does decrease cardiac output.
Okay.
So that is one thing you have to be careful about, is that if an animal has any sort of critical illness and you're going to drop the cardiac output even slightly with alpha-2s, they could decompensate.
Okay.
Those patients with like cardiac disease, if we vasoconstrict them, even if out in the periphery, if we measured the blood pressure, it's still a drop in their cardiac output, so they still could decompensate.
And did you say for that reason you want to avoid them in an animal, for example, with mitral valve disease, because you're increasing peripheral, so it's harder for the heart to push the blood out, so you're going to get more back pressure.
And then more goes backwards through that mitral valve and into the left atrium, which could be teetering on the edge of left heart failure. And if you push that volume a little bit more...
I feel like I've kind of always avoided it in a potentially sick patient, including a cardiac patient, but I didn't quite know why. I just felt like it's not the safest combination, but it's nice to know. So in a cardiac patient, stay away from the alpha-2s.
And same thing with dogs who have poor contractility. If you increase the afterload and it's harder for the heart to pump blood forward, most of those dogs don't have enough myocardial strength to push harder, overcome that afterload, and maintain cardiac output. So like dilated cardiomyopathies... Okay. So mitral valve dogs.
So anything heart-wise, alpha-2s.
I try to avoid,
You talk quite a bit about methadone.
Yeah.
Did you say in your talk that it has an NMDA antagonist effect?
It does.
In addition to the opioid effect.
In addition to the opioid.
So that's like ketamine, right?
Very similar to ketamine. So it's providing analgesia in a different route.
And is it just methadone, or do any of the others have that NMDA effect?
Just the methadone with that snazzy little effect.
That's cool. So your methadone, ketamine, midazolam combination, sedative dose, what sort of dose range are we at?
Yeah. You know, for an animal, like we use this combination in that presentation on a fractious cat who had a cat bite wound. And so our goal was to sedate her to the point where we could place an IV catheter and then do wound care. So for that somewhat vigorous and fractious animal, and we had no idea if she had comorbidities. Yeah. We could not put hands
on her.
She was
old, if I recall.
But she was 14.
She was old. So assuming that it's not all firing perfectly.
So we went high on the doses for her. We did 0.4 mgs per kg of methadone, which is really at the high end of my dose range.
I had a British anaesthetist talk about opioids with me on the podcast.
and he talked about the American doses.
Yeah. Go hard. But especially for fractious cats, I start high. Okay. Because if you start low and they get ticked off, you're in a losing battle.
Then you only have one shot. You may as well go hard.
The ketamine will usually start at 5 mg per kg. Okay. If you go higher on ketamine, they'll sleep longer. So you could go up on the ketamine if you wanted a more prolonged sedation. And then the midazolam will usually start at like a 0.5 mg per kg dose. Okay. But if I had a really sick patient, and sometimes we'll use this combination in an animal who needs to go on the ventilator, who maybe has really severe pneumonia and they're trending towards a state of sepsis from their pneumonia, and I just need to intubate very quickly, I would probably cut that methadone in half to start, because I don't want to wallop them.
Yeah.
I do want them to get sedate very quickly in order to intubate. But I might
So you'd intubate with that mix? That'll be enough for you to intubate?
Especially if they're sick.
If they're
absolutely
sick. And that's still going IM, or is that IV at that dose?
Ideally, that would be IV at
IV,
that
okay.
point.
Okay, so she wasn't committed. The statement you just made about the ketamine, the higher dose will make them sleep longer, but not necessarily be more sedated. That's new to me.
Is it?
That. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember somebody telling me that during my residency, and it too, it was like a aha moment that, oh, that's how that works. And
obviously, not infinitely. Is there a point where they get really whacked out or not necessarily? Is it just sleep?
Yes, there's a point where you could induce more of like an anesthetic state with that. But you could double those like a 10 mg per kg, and instead of it lasting 20 to 30 minutes, you'd probably get 30 to 45, 50 minutes of sedate cat if you go up on that ketamine dose.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Great.
I prefer, rather than going up on my ketamine dose, I typically prefer to just redose at that 20-minute mark if I'm not done with what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if you go high on the dose and the cat's going to sleep for an hour and you only needed them to sleep for 20 minutes, you're just stuck.
And you're just redosing the ketamine in that scenario?
I redose ketamine and midazolam. I want those two to stay in combo.
Okay, so the midaz also runs out fairly
quickly.
Yes,
about 20 to 30 minutes.
Associate Professor.
Yes.
Shane Bateman.
Hello.
Thank you so much for sitting down.
It's my great pleasure.
I mean, we're constantly talking about burnout and people leaving the profession and staff shortages. And it's probably, I don't know, am I right or in saying that it's probably one of the major drivers is that moral, what's the word for it?
Moral distress.
Moral distress that I feel.
We all feel
20
it.
Years in, I still, I've run a business, so I understand why the money has to be a part of it.
Right.
It's if I don't earn money, I can't run my hospital.
Yeah.
And I like nice stuff.
We all do.
But I also like treating animals.
Yes. You know, I think somewhere along the way, our profession has gotten lost. We've lost our way. And I think the mental health crisis that we all find ourselves facing every day is multifactorial, obviously. But I think there are some core aspects around the moral distress that we all feel and the ethical dilemmas that we all face in the work that we do every day.
And then people get angry at the clients.
Yeah, that's not fair.
Which is not really fair.
No.
Or maybe they, deep down, my theory is sometimes we're kind of angry at ourselves because you feel like this is not who I am.
Right.
It's not what I sign up to do.
Right.
But then it's like a dog getting angry at the dog at the other side of the fence. The fucking clients.
Yeah.
They shouldn't. You said the words yesterday. If you can't afford to have a pet, you shouldn't have a pet.
Right.
How does that make me feel, that statement?
I think we're all human, and I was socialized and normalized growing up as a person and growing up as a professional. No, I believed that at one point in my life, too.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I've been exposed to a lot of different experiences that have helped shape how I think about these things now. And I shudder thinking about how I used to think about it, but I'm glad that I've had the opportunity to grow and to learn and to be leading others in thinking about this differently.
How do you teach spectrum of care without compromising standards? Because that's when I said my training is a double-edged sword, in a business where I'm supposed to charge well and generate income, I often will default to, well, I know I can do this for way cheaper and get away with it.
Yep.
Often it's harder for me to offer them.
Right.
The correct treatment.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so much of that aspect of this work comes from those experiences, right? You get out there and you try something and it doesn't work and you learn, and the next time you try it again and, you know, maybe it works this time. And so you learn a little bit of what you can get away with.
Yeah, and that's that get away with.
It's right? Not always the right way. And I, you know, maybe that's bad choice of words, because I think even in gold standard medicine in the ICU where I'm practicing and teaching students in a, you know, multi-million dollar facility that has the latest technology in it, we don't get away with things at times.
That's
too
very true.
And so I think we catch ourselves in, you know, we've rationalized it, but, you know, so much of whether animals respond to treatment or don't respond to treatment, our egos want us to believe that it's because what we did or didn't do. And sometimes what happens is in spite of us, not because of us. So I think to do this work well, you really have to believe in the possibility and to remain hopeful and to trust that all of the right factors will come together to lead to a positive outcome. And at the same time, you have to be skillful and empathic enough to be able to guide someone and a family through the possibility when it doesn't.
Professor Michael Scheer, thank you so much. I feel privileged to have you on the Ventfeld.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
IVEX 2023.
Yes.
And co-hosting today, we have Dr. Eli Lester, friend and colleague and director and emergency critical care specialist from Animal Emergency Australia. I went to Dr. Reagan Wales' talk as well, and she talked about looking for echinocytes or echinocytes.
Yeah. Echinocytes will it's a pretty sensitive test, because the red cells will show these little spikes coming out of the red cells within 10 minutes.
So does that work for us?
Yep.
Yeah. So why has nobody ever told me this, Ellie?
Yeah. You probably haven't come to lectures and paid attention. Yeah, yeah, have a look at a blood smear for your red belly blacks. Yeah, definitely.
And that's as quick as well?
Yep.
And just for the blacks, what about the browns?
The browns don't have the hemolysin component, so we don't seem to see it in them. But yeah, definitely your red belly blacks and your tigers.
Tigers as well?
Yeah, and there's been some really cool research done on taipans where they looked at venom concentration with red cells and then had electron microscopy where they looked at the red cells, and it's concentration dependent as to how many you'll get. So if you've got a severe envenomation and you've got wall-to-wall echinocerocytes.
Because for us, where we work on the East Coast, there's several conditions that can kind of look the same as a snake bite. So even just an anaphylaxis case can look like am I collapsed because I've got a bee sting anaphylaxis, or am I collapsed because I've got a snake bite? So you say that's a great little blood smear. And if you have a lot of echinocytes, black snake.
Enough further up your list.
The other question related to that, you talked about that re-envenomation, so the bite site slow release over days. Is that a thing for us, or do you know? Do their leopards do the same thing, or is it more of a viper venom?
It's not so much of a problem in Australia because you're using a different anti-venom.
Okay.
In Australia, most of your anti-venoms are IgG. And they stay around longer. The re-envenomation problem surfaced to the forefront because of the use of Crofab, which is very pure, doesn't have that extra equine protein on it, and it doesn't stay around long enough.
Is it just because of the size of the molecule that
it
gets eliminated?
It chases the venom into the tissues, and that's it.
Whereas the bigger molecules hang around in the bloodstream. Yeah. For how long do the IgG ones hang around? Are we talking days or?
IgG ones, they say 86 hours.
Oh, right. So a significant amount of time.
We've checked them out three to 5 days.
3 to 5 days.
But that's just the presence in the bloodstream, not necessarily an effective presence at that late time.
Okay.
You want everything to work as in the first several hours.
Okay. Because our black snakes will sometimes do that, right? They come back in 4 days later, hemolyzing again. You send them home happy, I've done a great job, and then they come back in. And you said to me once, we think it's venom effect. It's not a It's not an IMHA reaction, it's venom.
We don't know. We're still trying to answer that question. There's some stuff where they previously thought it was a delayed IMHA, but we've now tracked out they have spherocytes on day one, and it's not an immune response.
That's always been a question. Will something like envenomation cause IMHA? My answer to that is probably not.
No. Okay. Yeah.
Because if they hemolyze acutely, then they go home, and 2 days later they rehemolyze, that's due to the venom.
Yeah.
It's refeeding into the bloodstream.
Okay, so if you get your patient come back a few days later, more antivenom is the answer.
So that's what we generally do. We'll give another vial of antivenom and blood products if needed and continue supportive care.
Dr. Matthew Booth. And we've got Dr. Lisa Brumby, who's a colleague of mine from Animal Emergency Australia. Australia's biggest, we think, biggest, but definitely best emergency group. So Lisa is part of a leadership team for an emergency clinic. So this topic of how do we keep emergency vets with the profession is a hot topic for you, right? An important thing.
An important, yeah, always.
What do you guys find, Lisa? What's our average turnaround for the average emergency vet from starting the internship program to tapping out?
It varies on the person. We do have team members such as myself that have been in there for close to 15 years.
Yeah.
But we do tend to have a hiatus at about that 3 to 5 year mark when people start to move on and out.
This experience and this 360-degree view is what has allowed me to be in this place currently to try to help our ER veterinarians, our current ER veterinarians, not looking at it from how we practiced when we were back in the day, because that time's long gone.
100%.
And literally hearing the voices of the people today that are on the floor or the ones that are coming up through the ranks that want to be on the floor and meeting the needs of those people so they can have thriving careers. And that's really where all of this comes from, is to really just keep our ears open and our minds open and never go back to yesterday and always keep striving for what they're looking for to improve their quality of life. But you were talking about like this crying or this feeling of almost like a burnout or I can't take it anymore.
Yeah.
Like what is it? It's actually a lot of things. Like you can go all the way down to the granular detail of like the schedule as an example. So I don't know if y'all have heard about this. That's what these ethos cards are here. These QR codes will get people to this. You can see my shirt. It's the ER vet schedule survey. So here's the deal. I shouldn't be creating a schedule from my perspective, 54-year-old man that's been doing this for 25 years, no. Like, what is going to be meaningful and impactful to the people on the floor today and tomorrow? And then handing all of this data off to the medical directors and the hospital directors that are now older, and they can actually see that and utilize it as a tool to actually meet their needs instead of creating an environment where they're like, I can't take it anymore because you're not seeing me for who I am.
I heard a statement once, or not a statement, but a description of being inside a business or inside a situation. But if you're inside the bottle, you can't read the label. And I like that because I feel like often when you're in a business, you're the leadership team, you're inside the bottle. And you're coming in as an outsider and you can read the label.
No,
Are there common things that people are missing out on that they are blind to within their own organizations that is affecting staff retention?
Everyone is going to think that I'm going to say toxicity is number one. That is not number one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I see, right? Yeah. You would think toxicity. So the number one place to point the arrow is a highly trained support staff, to create a highly trained support staff. CSRs, VAs, and technicians, VTSs. That is without question number
CSR,
one.
CSR, let's go through them. CSR, customer support.
Veterinary assistants, right? Technicians and VTS technicians. Yeah. And I honestly would lean in predominantly into that whole VA tech area as the greatest need with the greatest potential for us to have thriving careers. Do you all have any idea what the number one factor for recruiting currently practicing ER vets in the U.S. non-DAC vets is? If I said I'm asking currently practicing, so not students interested, but actually currently practicing emergency veterinarians in the U.S. that are not DAC vets, what is the number one thing in a hospital that they want?
Well, did you just give us the answer before when you said
you're right.
Good support?
That's right. That's right. So here's an interesting thing. back in my day, which is a long, long time ago, but I'll bet some of these people listening can relate to this, we wanted to make sure they had all the analgesics that we were supposed to have in the hospital and all the cool toys. And that's what we were told to go look for. But think about this for a second. We're struggling with obtaining, recruiting, retaining staff, technical staff, veterinary assistant staff. And obviously, let's be clear, they have to be paid a wage that's going to allow them to thrive. Okay, so that needs to be understood regardless of this job or another job. But one of the biggest factors for them is to have autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And those are the ways that they can continue to thrive. And then what will then happen is that we'll be able to recruit these amazing ER veterinarians and create an environment for them to thrive. So they can then practice their highest level, and then they continue to grow as professionals.
Dr. Paul Aldridge, thank you so much for joining us on the VetWorld Couch at IVEX 2023.
Thanks for having me.
A surgeon in the land of emergency and critical care. The bleeding abdomen, though, the traumatic, we got my happy, show me a bleeding spleen from a bleeding tumor. I know what to do with those, but hit by car or some sort of trauma.
Nine times out of ten, it's going to be the spleen. But what if you open up the abdomen?
So even in trauma, it's still most likely to be splenic?
Yeah. Following a traumatic hemoabdomen, I still think statistically spleen is most likely.
Okay.
To hemorrhage.
So who are the next likely candidates to start bleeding if something gets worse with a blood trauma?
That's the order we were tackling them. I mean, if it's not the spleen, next likely is the liver.
Yep.
If it's not the liver after that, it's usually the kidney.
Okay.
And it's usually the left kidney because it sits further caudal. And then after that, it's the odd thing like mesenteric avulsions. The aim of the talk was just to get some basic systematic approach to it in terms of the exploration and then some straightforward techniques in terms of trying to arrest things. We were touching on the subject of damage control surgery. We have to do something definitive there and then while the patient's relatively unstable, or is there something we can do just to restore normal physiology, recover the patient and come back with something definitive?
So do we have to do something? You mean you're still going in because you've got to stop the bleed, but I don't have to fix it and polish it and make it
exactly
tie it in a bow?
Yeah.
I can...
Exactly that.
Okay.
So the idea behind damage control surgery is well established in the human field, but we've not really got the same statistics or the same studies on the veterinary side. So the idea behind it is, by definition with a hemoabdomen patient, unfortunately, we're getting them as surgeons because they're unstable.
Yes.
Because by definition, they didn't successfully managed conservatively.
So yeah, again, we won't talk about the ECC part, but again, generally with an acute hemoabdomen, that you try not to go to surgery
exactly
if you can help it. Yeah.
90% of traumatic hemoabdomens are conservatively managed. So by definition, the ones you're getting are the unstable ones.
It's going to be
dodgy
anesthetic.
You're going to go from there. So idea behind damage control surgery in the human field is that it's a quick, abbreviated procedure to reestablish normal physiology.
Okay.
So you stop hemorrhage, you stop leaks. You recover the patient, they have another 24 hours of stabilization, and then you come back to definitively resect an anastomose or liver lobectomy if you have to at that point.
And the reason for that is to minimize anesthetic time in
the
unstable patient.
It's to minimize what they call the second hit, or the triad of death, as it were. If you've got a patient probably already coagulopathic because of the bleeding that's going on, they might be hypothermic, they might be hypotensive.
Yeah.
If you then take that patient to theater and spend 3 hours with them, their body temperature is only going to go lower. They're probably going to become more acidotic due to poor perfusion. So you're adding a second insult, if you like.
That makes a lot of sense.
So you're trying
to
get in, get out, improve the patient without causing a deterioration.
How do you systematically approach it?
I tend to have a set approach to explore every abdomen. If you've just become second nature that you're going to explore every abdomen in the same way,
okay,
you're not picking, choosing, grabbing, and potentially missing something from there.
Okay.
So it's usually, you're talking yesterday's, self-retaining retractors in, falciform ligament and fat out the way so you can see what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
In case of the hemoabdomen, we're going to suction from there. And then we usually just take it systematically. First, you're looking forwards at the diaphragm, looking at the body wall, looking at the peritoneal cavity itself. Then we start in the cranial abdomen, spleen, liver, gallbladder. Then usually gastrointestinal tract, working your way from the stomach, feeling all the way down. Then we usually go right paravertebral gutter. So it's the duodenal maneuver to drag everything across. Yep. So we look on the right-hand side, kidney, adrenal gland, caudate lobe of the liver, ovary.
So you're taking your duodenum, lifting it, and using that little
curtain. Using the duodenum as a natural retractor because it's a short, broad, mesentery, the mesoduodenum. Mm. So if we pack all the abdominal contents behind the duodenum, you can retract the whole lot, hold it with one hand. All the abdominal contents out the way with one hand leaves you something to do with. So we do that on the right side. Then on the left side, you do similar with the colon. Okay. The colonic maneuver, we can use the mesocolon to retract everything to the midline. And we're looking left kidney, left adrenal glands, aortas down there if we want it on that side. And then finally, the caudal abdomen. So usually to flick in the bladder about retroflexing it and looking in the caudal abdomen.
Okay.
So if you come across an active bleeder, we pack it while you continue the rest of the exploration.
But okay.
I want the whole of the exploration done and then go back and knowing what I'm going to tackle with really.
Okay, so you're not... You don't go, oh, there's my bleed. Let me focus on that. You temporarily...
I would pack it. I would have a look around the rest of the abdomen because you may have found the minor bleed. Yeah. Spend 20 minutes ligating a spleen if the renal artery is pumping out.
Mm.
So I think I would always want to know. Full complete explore. You know, may have to pack something, may have to temporarily clamp something. I'm not going to do anything definitive until I've done the whole explore.
So stick your finger in the damn wall.
Exactly. Yeah. Very, very brief damage. You know, pack it with a couple of lap pads or something, but I think I'd want the whole explore done before I started to tackle anything that's going to be lengthy. That's super useful. Really. And then next step we were talking about in terms of that conservative kind of management would be to do the Pringle manoeuvre at the same time.
Okay, what's that?
So Pringle manoeuvre, we're looking at this reference yesterday, 1908. So we're bang up to date in terms of our references yesterday. So Pringle first described this technique for arresting hepatic hemorrhage during exlapse over 100 years ago.
Humans or animals?
Humans.
Okay.
So the father of damage control surgery, as it were. And it's just a question of finding the hepatoduodenal ligament.
Okay.
So we're doing the duodenal maneuver again. And if we're looking at the vena cava, the epiploic foramen is just going to be cranially. Now, to the side of that epiploic foramen is the hepatoduodenal ligament.
Okay.
So it contains the common bile duct coming out of the liver, and it contains the portal vein and the hepatic artery.
Okay.
So if you stick your finger in there and pinch, you can total vascular occlusion. Okay. So we can stop inflow to the liver for 10 to 15 minutes in a normothermic patient. So it's a very straightforward technique. You know, very often things won't clot because the pressure's too high and the flow's too much.
Okay, so you basically
so if I can
just
pinch this off, temporary occlusion,
allowing the clot to stay there and not just keep going off. Okay.
So it's a worthwhile, it's a very basic, very straightforward, very easy technique. You know, but trouble is people only tend to look for it when they need it in a panic.
Yes.
So we just suggest the next abdomen you open up for a foreign body.
Go look for it.
Whatever, have a look.
That's a great idea.
Have a look, have a check.
Yeah.
One day you may need it, and then might be a bit easier to find in an adrenaline-fueled situation.
Yeah. Dr. Leo Londoño, thank you so much for sitting down on the couch with the Vet Belt at IVEX 2023.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, next topic, the other one is my dog's eaten a whole box of my ibuprofen, or name your anti-inflammatory. Yeah. I don't know what's popular in the US, but for us it's often ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen is the most common one.
It's the most common one there. So the traditional approach until kind of forever as well, let's get you in hospital. Obviously if there's decontamination options, we won't go into that, but the fluid part of that is to go, we've got to get you on fluids for 48 hours because we want to make sure that we perfuse your kidneys and flush out the NSAID, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Nope.
I don't know.
So again, going back to the pharmacokinetics of NSAIDs, if you look at NSAIDs, they're 95% bound to albumin. If you're doing fluid diuresis...
You're not flushing albumin through the glomerulus.
No, unless you don't have a healthy glomerulus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because albumin weighs 69,000 daltons.
Yeah, it's staying well and truly.
It's a big molecule. Yeah. The glomerulus lets pass some very small molecular weight proteins, but they're reabsorbed by the proximal tubular epithelium. But the glomerulus doesn't let albumin pass unless there is an existing glomerulopathy. So what's the reason to do fluid diuresis on a dog with NSAIDs? There is none.
Makes no sense. So how do we clear NSAIDs? Is it hepatically cleared?
Well, there is both ways. Some of them are hepatic, some of them are renal.
Okay.
So the
little bit of unbound percentage will get peed out, but it's only like, 95% bound?
95%
or more. 5% of circulating NSAID is And what's the half-life? I know it varies drug to drug, but...
Most of them are between 8 and 12 hours.
Okay.
So that's why we make that recommendation, because, again, when you give recommendations for fluid therapy to increase excretion through the kidneys, you want to do 3 times the half-life of a drug to achieve at least a 60 to 65% reduction of the drug from circulation. Mm-hmm. So 3 times the half-life. That puts us at 36 hours or so of hospitalization with most NSAIDs.
Yeah.
If we were going to do fluid therapy for NSAIDs. Now, how about naproxen?
I don't know naproxen.
You don't know naproxen?
No, I've heard of it, but I don't. Yeah. It's not common for us, so tell me about it.
Naproxen is a very common human NSAID, okay? And we see a lot of exposure to that NSAID here in the U.S.
Yeah. Is naproxen the active ingredient? That's not the brand? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And the half-life of naproxen is 72 to 74 hours.
Whoa.
So technically, if you have a patient that ingests naproxen, you have to put that patient on fluids for 9 days.
And it's also albumin-bound, like all that. Yeah. This might... Yeah, you know, let me think about this before I ask it. So how do the NSAIDs damage the kidneys? It is to do with blood supply, right?
Right.
So it's not directly nephrotoxic by the chemicals sitting in the tubule, damaging tubular cells. Because the other theory with why do we put animals on fluids is because you don't want the toxin to linger in the tubules. You want, once it's through the glomerulus, you got to get the hell out of there. But it's not...
No, then it's not directly nephrotoxic. The damage to the kidneys is mediated by prostaglandin inhibition. And when there is no prostaglandin, there is no afferent arterial vasodilation.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So technically you have a vasoconstriction, the hypoxic damage to the kidneys.
So the kidney's sad because it's not getting enough oxygen, basically.
Right,
yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
This dogmatic approach of fluid therapy for the NSAID dog doesn't really make a lot of pharmacological sense. And that's a very strong consensus that in the IRIS society, amongst nephrologists is there, you know? I'm part of the IRIS AKI guidelines, and we discussed that in patients with NSAID toxicity, fluid therapy, there is really no evidence to prove that it makes a difference.
I feel like you should say the sentence, you don't need to put your NSAID toxicities on fluids for 2-3 days and then you should drop that microphone and walk away.
No, and you look at it for patients, because technically, you know, IV fluids could have a detrimental effect too.
Yeah.
Right? Especially if you're not monitoring body weight, you can overload them. Even if they have subclinical AKI with no azotemia, they can retain water. Mm-hmm. So they have that. And then one point that was very well taken in the audience was, you know, workload for our ICU nurses.
Oh, yeah. And the problem is they're almost always puppies, and they're almost always really annoying.
Exactly.
So they sit there for 2-3 days barking their heads off and chewing their drip lines.
Exactly. You know, we talk about how short-staffed sometimes the hospitals are, how difficult it is to get ICU nurses, and then we're overloading them with work. Mm-hmm. That truly is no evidence to support the use of fluids on NSAID toxicity.
Dr. Temple Graydon, what an absolute privilege and pleasure to have you on the VetVault podcast.
Well, it's great to be here.
You're very outspoken and very well known for being a very high-functioning autistic person. Yep. Our profession, and I think specifically the emergency group of veterinarians, there's a fair high percentage of people who would classify themselves as neurodivergent of some sort.
Well, I have to talk more about steel fabrication, as I spent 25 years in heavy construction. And I'm going to estimate that about 20% of the people that I worked with that owned metal fabrication shops were either autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD. Uh-huh. Some of these people had 20 patents each. Most of them couldn't do algebra. And the thing is, we need those skills.
Yeah.
And some of those people would be very, very good at emergency medicine.
Yeah.
Because one of the skills of a visual thinker is mechanical things. Yep. You just see how things work.
Yep. Yeah, I feel like there's a certain kind of person that's drawn, because especially the critical care aspect, you have to think a lot about, you know, that what's happening to the patient, how can I adjust it? So they love the science of it, and they're really good at it, But then associated with that, for us as veterinarians, is human relationships and working with people and working with clients. The challenge for many people like that, though, you talk about that 20-30% of people, it's quite hard for them to deal with co-workers and with clients and that.
What has to be done, with a social awkwardness, they have to be coached like somebody in a foreign country. Okay. Nothing is obvious. On one of my early jobs, I criticized welding, and I said it looked like pigeon do. And the plant engineer pulled me in his office, said you have to apologize for that kind of rude talk. And he told me what I should do. Okay, if they interact with a client in a rude way, pull them aside and explain to them how to interact with a client. Or watch Jim, how he interacts with a client. Then copy the way he interacts with a client. They'll need to be coached. And you can't be vague. You can't say you're not a team player. That's too vague. That doesn't work. And you take them off in private, and you tell them in private, calmly, what they did wrong, and then how to improve.
Okay. So it is just training. So for yourself, because you deal with the public all the time, here we are chatting to a stranger, and it's potentially very social situations. So the fact that you are good at it, was it just coaching over the years, more exposure? Okay,
I do have a problem with interrupting, and I did, start talking when you were still talking. I have a slow processor speed, and I have problems sometimes in conversation finding the right time to break in. And that has to do with slow processor speed. There's other things I'm really good at, and when I first started out, the way I sold jobs is just to show off my drawings and show off my pictures, and people would go, well, you did that? Then I got respect.